danger. Stakeouts, takedowns, high-pressure situations, moments of extreme stress. What's the first thing you did afterward? Franklin glanced at the women.
Went to the bathroom, he said.
Correct, Reacher said.
Me too.
But James Barr didn't. Bel Antonio's report from Barr's house shows cement dust in the garage, the kitchen, the living room, the bedroom, and the basement, but not in the bathroom. So he got home, but he didn't take a leak until after he changed and showered. And how could he shower, anyway, without going into the bathroom?
Maybe he stopped on the way.
He was never there.
He was there, Reacher. What about the evidence?
There's no evidence that says he was there.
Are you nuts?
There's evidence that says his van was there, and his shoes, and his pants, and his coat, and his gun, and his ammo, and his quarter. But there's nothing that says he was there.
Someone impersonated him?
Anyani asked.
Down to the last detail, Reacher said.
Drove his car. Wore his shoes and his clothes, used his gun.
This is fantasy, Franklin said.
It explains the raincoat, Reacher said. A big, roomy garment that covered everything except the denim jeans? Why else wear a raincoat on a warm, dry day?
Who?
Rosemary asked.
Watch, Reacher said.
He stood still, and then he took a single pace forward. My pants are 37-inch legs, he said. I crossed the new part of the garage in 35 strides. James Barr has a 34-inch leg, which means he should have done it in about 38 strides. But Bel Antonio's footprint count shows 48 strides.
A very short person, Helen said.
Charlie, Rosemary said.
I thought so, too, Reacher said. But then I went to Kentucky, initially because I wanted to confirm something else. I got around to thinking that maybe James Barr just wasn't good enough. I looked at the scene. It was tough shooting. And 14 years ago, he was good, but he wasn't great. And when I saw him in the hospital, the skin on his right shoulder was unmarked. And to shoot as well as he apparently did, a guy's got to practice. And a guy who practices builds up bruising on his shoulder, like a callus. He didn't have it. So I figured a guy who started out average could only have gotten worse with time, especially if he wasn't practicing much. That's logical, right? Maybe he'd gotten to the point where he couldn't have done the thing on Friday, through a simple lack of ability. That's what I was thinking. So I went down to Kentucky to find out for sure how much worse he had gotten.
And?
Helen asked.
He had gotten better, Reacher said. Way better. Not worse.
Look at this. He took the target out of his shirt pocket and unfolded it. This is the latest of 32 sessions over the last 3 years. And this is much better than he was shooting when he was in the Army 14 years ago. Which is weird, right? He's fired only 320 rounds in the last 3 years. And he's great. Whereas he was firing 2,000 a week back when he was only average.
So, what does this mean?
He went down there with Charlie every time. And the guy who runs the range is a Marine champion, and a real anal pack rat. He files all the used targets, which means that Barr had at least two witnesses to what he was scoring every time.
I'd want witnesses, Franklin said, if I was shooting like that.
It's not possible to get better by not practicing, Reacher said. I think the truth is, he had actually gotten really bad, and I think his ego couldn't take it. Any shooter is competitive, He knew he was lousy now and he couldn't face it, and he wanted to cover it up. He wanted to show off. Franklin pointed at the target.
Doesn't look lousy to me.
This is faked, Reacher said. You're going to give this to Bell'Antonio, and Bell'Antonio is going to prove it to you.
Faked, huh?
I'll bet this was done with a handgun. 9mm, from point-blank range. If Bell'Antonio measures the holes, my guess is he'll find they're 46/1000ths of an inch bigger than 308 holes. And if he tests the paper, he'll find gunpowder residue on it. Because my guess is, James Barr took a stroll down the range and made these holes from an inch away, not 300 yards. Every time.
That's a stretch.
It's simple metaphysics. Barr was never this good, and it's fair to assume he must have gotten worse. If he'd gotten a little worse, he'd have owned up to it. But he didn't own up to it, so we can assume he'd gotten a lot worse. Bad enough to be seriously embarrassed about it. Maybe bad enough that he couldn't hit the paper at all. Nobody spoke. It's a theory that proves itself, Reacher said. To fake the score because of embarrassment proves he couldn't shoot well anymore. If he couldn't shoot well anymore, he didn't do the thing on Friday.
You're just guessing, Franklin said.
Reacher nodded. I was, but I'm not now. Now I know for sure. I fired a round down in Kentucky. The guy made me, like a rite of passage. I was full of caffeine. I was twitching like crazy. Now I know James Barr will have been way worse.
Why?
Rosemary asked. Because he has Parkinson's disease, Reacher said to her. P.A. means paralysis agitans, and paralysis agitans is what doctors call Parkinson's disease. Your brother is getting sick, I'm afraid, shaking and twitching. And no way on earth can you fire a rifle accurately with Parkinson's disease. My opinion? Not only didn't he do the thing on Friday, he couldn't possibly have done it. Rosemary went quiet. Good news and bad news. She glanced at the window, looked at the floor. She was dressed like a widow. Black silk blouse, black pencil skirt, black nylons, black patent leather shoes with a low heel.
Maybe that's why he was so angry all the time, she said. Maybe he felt it coming on, felt helpless and out of control. His body started to let him down. He would have hated that. Anyone would.
Then she looked straight at Reacher.
I told you he was innocent, she said.
Ma'am, I apologize, unreservedly, Reacher said. You were right. He reformed. He kept to his bargain. He deserves credit, and I'm sorry he's sick.
Now you've got to help him. You promised.
I am helping him. Since Monday night, I haven't done anything else.
This is crazy, Franklin said.
No, it's exactly the same as it always was, Reacher said. It's someone setting James Barr up for the fall. But instead of actually making him do it, they just made it look like he did it. That's the only practical difference here.
But is it possible?
Anyani asked.
Why not?
Think it through. Walk it through. Anyani walked it through. She rehearsed little movements slowly, thoughtfully, like an actress.
He dresses in Barr's clothes and shoes, and maybe finds a quarter in a jar or in a pocket somewhere. He wears gloves so as not to mess up Barr's fingerprints. He's already taken the traffic cone from Barr's garage, maybe the day before. He gets the rifle from the basement. It's already been loaded by Barr himself, previously. He drives to town in Barr's minivan. He leaves all the clues, covers himself in cement dust, comes back to the house, and puts everything away and leaves. Fast, not even taking the time to use the bathroom. Then James Barr comes home sometime later and walks into a trap he doesn't even know is there.
That's exactly how I see it, Reacher said.
But where was Barr at the time? Helen said.
Out, Reacher said. That's a nice coincidence, Franklin said. I don't think it was, Reacher said. I think they arranged something to get him out of the way. He remembers going out somewhere, previously, then being optimistic, like something good was about to happen. I think they set him up with someone. I think they engineered a chance meeting that led somewhere. I think he had a date on Friday.
With who?
Sandy, maybe. They turned her loose on me. Maybe they turned her loose on him, too. He dressed well on Friday. The report shows his wallet was in a decent pair of pants.
So, who really did it?
Helen asked. Someone cold as ice, Reacher said. Someone who didn't even need to use the bathroom afterward.
Charlie,
Rosemary said.
Got to be. Has to be. He's small. He's weird. He knew the house. He knew where everything was. The dog knew him.
He was a terrible shooter, too, Reacher said. That's the other reason why I went to Kentucky. I wanted to test that theory.
So, who was it?
Charlie, Reacher said. His evidence was faked, too, but in a different way. The holes in his targets were all over the place. Except, they weren't really all over the place. The distribution wasn't entirely random. He was trying to disguise how good he actually was. He was aiming at arbitrary points on the paper, and he was hitting those points every time, dead on, believe me. Once in a while he would get bored, and he'd put one through the inner ring, or he'd pick on a quadrant outside the outer ring and put a round straight through it. One time he drilled all four corners. The point is, it doesn't really matter what you aim at as long as you hit it. It's only convention that makes us aim at the ten ring. It's just as good practice to aim at some other spot, even a spot off the paper, like a tree. That's what Charlie was doing. He was a tremendous shot, training hard, but trying to look like he was missing all the time. But like I said, true randomness is impossible for a human to achieve. There are always patterns.
Why would he do that?
Helen asked.
For an alibi.
Making people think he couldn't shoot?
Reacher nodded. He noticed that the rangemaster was saving the used targets. He's an ice-cold pro who thinks about every wrinkle ahead of time.
Who is he? Franklin asked.
His real name is Chenko, and he hangs with a bunch of Russians. He's probably a Red Army veteran, probably one of their snipers. And they're real good. They always have been.
How do we get to him?
Through the victim.
Square one. The victims are all dead ends. You'll have to come up with something better than that.
His boss calls himself the Zek.
What kind of a name is that?
It's a word, not a name. Old-time Soviet slang. A Zek was a labor camp inmate in the Gulag in Siberia. Those camps are ancient history, which makes the Zek a very old man. But a very tough old man. Probably way tougher than we can imagine.
The Zek was tired after his stint with the backhoe, but he was used to being tired. He had been tired for 63 years. He had been tired since the day the recruiter came to his village in the early fall of 1942. His village was 4,000 miles from anywhere,
and the recruiter was a type of Moscow Russian nobody had ever seen before. He was brisk and self-assured and confident. He permitted no argument, no discussion. All males between the ages of 16 and 50 were to come with him. The Zek was 17 at that point. Initially, he was overlooked because he was in prison. He had slept with an older man's wife and then beaten the guy badly when he complained about it. The beaten guy claimed exemption from the draft because of his physical condition, and then he told the recruiter about his assailant in prison. The recruiter was anxious to make his numbers, so the Zek was hauled out of his cell and told to line up with the others in the village square. He did so quite happily. He assumed he was being given a ride to freedom. He assumed there would be 100 opportunities just to walk away. He was wrong. The recruits were locked into a truck, and then a train, for a journey that lasted 5 weeks. Formal induction into the Red Army happened along the way. Uniforms were issued, thick woolen garments and a coat and a pair of felt-lined boots and a pay book, but no actual pay, no weapons, and no training either, beyond a brief stop in a snow-covered rail yard, where a commissar brayed over and over again at the locked train through a huge metal megaphone. The guy repeated a simple 20-word speech, which the Zek remembered ever afterward. "The fate of the world is being decided at Stalingrad, where you will fight to the last for the motherland." The 5-week journey ended on the eastern bank of the Volga, where the recruits were unloaded like cattle and forced to run straight for a small assemblage of old river ferries and pleasure cruisers. Half a mile away on the opposite bank was a vision from hell. A city, larger than anything the Zek had ever seen before, was in ruins, belching smoke and fire. The river was burning and exploding with mortar shells. The sky was full of airplanes which lined up and fell into dives, dropping bombs, firing guns. There were corpses everywhere, and body parts and screaming wounded. The Zek was forced onto a small boat that had a gaily colored, striped sunshade. It was crammed tight with soldiers. Nobody had room to move. Nobody had a weapon. The boat lurched out into the freezing current, and airplanes fell on it like flies on shit. The crossing lasted 15 minutes, and at the end of it, the Zek was slimy with his neighbor's blood. He was forced off onto a narrow wooden pier and made to line up single file, and then made to run toward the city, past a staging post where the second phase of his military training took place. Two quartermasters were doling out loaded rifles and spare ammunition clips in an endless alternate sequence, and chanting what later struck the Zek as a poem, or a song, or a hymn, to complete and utter insanity, over and over again, without pausing. The one with the rifle shoots. The one without follows him. When the one with the rifle is killed, the one who is following picks up the rifle and shoots. The Zek was handed an ammunition clip. No rifle. He was shoved forward and blindly followed the back of the man ahead. He turned a corner, passed in front of a Red Army machine gun nest. At first he thought the front line must therefore be very close. But then a commissar with a flag and another huge megaphone roared at him, "No retreat! If you turn back even one step, we will shoot you down!" So the Zek ran helplessly onward and turned another corner and stepped into a hail of German bullets. He stopped, half-turned, and was hit 3 times in the arms and legs. He was bowled over and came to rest lying on the shattered remains of a brick wall, and within minutes was buried under a mounting pile of corpses. He came to 48 hours later in an improvised hospital and made his first acquaintance with Soviet military justice. harsh, ponderous, ideological, but running strictly in accordance with its own arcane rules. The matter at issue was caused by his having half-turned. Were his wounds inflicted by the motherland's enemy, or had he been retreating toward his own side's guns? Because of the physical ambiguity, he was spared execution and sentenced to a penal battalion instead. Thus began a process of survival that had so far lasted 63 years. A process he intended to continue. He dialed Grigor Linsky's number. "We can assume the soldier is talking," he said. "Whatever he knows, they all know now. Therefore, it's time to get ourselves an insurance policy." Franklin said, "We're really no further ahead, are we? No way is Emerson going to accept a damn thing unless we give him more than we've got right now." "So work the victim list," Reacher said. "That could take forever. 5 lives? 5 life histories? So let's focus."
"Great! Terrific! Just, tell me which one you want me to focus on?"
Reacher nodded, recalled Helen Roden's description of what she had heard. The first shot, and then a tiny pause, and then the next two, then another pause, a little longer, but really only a split second, and then the last 3. He closed his eyes. In his mind, he pictured Bellantonio's audiograph from the cell phone voicemail, pictured his own mute simulation in the gloom of the new parking garage, his right arm extended like a rifle. Click, 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 click. "Not the first one," he said. "Not the first cold shot. No guarantee of hitting anything with that. Therefore, the first victim was meaningless, part of the window dressing. Not the last 3, either. That was bang, bang, bang. The deliberate miss, and more window dressing. The job was already done by then."
"So, the second, or the third, or both of them?"
Click, click, click. Reacher opened his eyes. "The third," he said. "There's a rhythm there. The first cold shot, then a lead-in, and then the money shot, the target, then a break. His eye is lagging in the scope. He's making sure the target is down." "It is. So then the last 3.
"Who was the third?"
Helen asked.
"The woman," Franklin said.
Linsky called Chenko, and then Vladimir, and then Sokolov. He explained the mission and pulled them all in tighter. Franklin's office had no back entrance. There was just the exposed staircase. The target's car was right there on the apron. Easy. Reacher said, "Tell me about the woman." Franklin shuffled his notes, put them in a new order of priority.
"Her name was Oline Archer," he said. "Caucasian female, married, no children, 37 years old, lived west of here in the outer suburbs."
"Employed in the DMV building," Reacher said. "If she was the specific target, Charlie had to know where she was and when she would be coming out." Franklin nodded.
"Employed by the DMV itself. Been there 1.5 years.
"Doing what, exactly?"
"Clerical supervisor. Doing whatever they do in there."
"So, was it work-related?"
Anyani asked.
"Too long of a counter, the way?" Franklin said. "A bad photo on a driver's license?" "I doubt it. I checked the national databases. DMV clerks don't get killed by customers. That just doesn't happen."
"So, what about her personal life?"
Helen Roden asked.
"Nothing jumped out at me," Franklin said. "She was just an ordinary woman. But I'll keep digging. I'll go down a few levels. Gotta be something there."
"Do it fast,"
Rosemary Barr said.
For my brother's sake, we have to get him out. We need medical opinions for that,
Anyani said.
Regular doctors now, not psychiatrists.
Will NBC pay?
Helen Roden asked.
If it's likely to work. It should,
Rosemary said.
I mean, shouldn't it? Parkinson's is a real thing, isn't it? Either he's got it or he hasn't.
It might work at trial, Reacher said. A plausible reason why James Barr couldn't have done it, plus a plausible narrative about someone else doing it. That's usually how you create reasonable doubt. Plausible is a big word, Franklin said. And reasonable doubt is a risky concept. Better to get Alex Roden to drop the charges altogether, which means convincing Emerson first. I can't talk to either one of them, Reacher said.
I can,
Helen said. I can, Franklin said.
And I sure as hell can,
Anyani said.
We all can, apart from you.
But you might not want to, Reacher said.
Why not? Helen asked. You're not going to like this part very much.
Why not?
Helen asked again. Think, Reacher said. Work backward. The thing with Sandy being killed, and the thing in the sports bar Monday night, why did those two things happen?
To tie you up,
to prevent you hurting the case, correct? Two attempts, same aim, same goal, same perpetrator.
Obviously.
And the thing Monday night started with me being followed from my hotel. Sandy and Jeb Oliver and his other pals were cruising around, standing by, waiting until someone called them and told them where I ended up. So really, it started with me being followed to my hotel, much earlier in the day.
We've been through all of this.
But how did the puppet master get my name? How did he even know I was in town? How did he know there was a guy here who was a potential problem?
Someone told him.
Who knew? Early in the day, on Monday? Helen paused a beat.
My father,
she said.
Since early on Monday morning. And then Emerson, presumably, shortly afterward. They'd have talked about the case. They'd have communicated immediately if there was a danger that the wheels were coming off.
Correct, Reacher said. Then one of those two guys called the puppet master. Well before lunch on Monday. Helen said nothing. Unless one of those two guys is the puppet master, Reacher said.
The Zek is the puppet master. You said so yourself.
I said he's Charlie's boss, that's all. We've got no way of knowing whether he's actually at the top of the tree.
You're right, Helen said. I don't like this line of thinking at all.
Someone communicated, Reacher said. That's for damn sure. Either your father or Emerson. My name was on the street 2 hours after I got off the bus. So one of them is bent, and the other one won't help us either because he already likes the case exactly the way it is. The room went quiet.
I need to get back to work,
Anyani said. Nobody spoke.
Call me if there's news,
Yanni said. The room stayed quiet. Reacher said nothing. Anyani crossed the room, stopped next to him.
Keys?
She said. He dug in his pocket and handed them over. Thanks for the loan, he said. Nice car. Linsky watched the Mustang leave. It went north. Loud engine, loud exhaust. It was audible for a whole block. Then the street went quiet again, and Linsky dialed his phone.
The television woman is out of there, he said. The private detective will stay at work, the Zek said. So what if the others leave together? I hope they don't. What if they do? take them all.
Rosemary Barr asked, Is there a cure for Parkinson's disease?
No, Reacher said. No cure, no prevention. But it can be slowed down. There are drugs for it. Physiotherapy helps, and sleep. The symptoms disappear when a person is asleep.
Maybe that's why he wanted the pills, to escape.
He shouldn't try to escape too much. Social contact is good.
I should go to the hospital, Rosemary said.
Explain to him, Reacher said. Tell him what really happened on Friday.
Rosemary nodded, crossed the room, and went out the door. A minute later, Reacher heard her car start up and drive away. Franklin went out to the kitchenette to make coffee. Reacher and Helen Roden were left alone in the office together. Reacher sat down in the chair that Rosemary Barr had used. Helen stepped to the window and looked down at the street below. She kept her back to the room. She was dressed the same as Rosemary Barr. Black shirt, black skirt, black patent leather shoes. But she didn't look like a widow. She looked like something from New York or Paris. Her heels were higher and her legs were long and bare and tan.
These guys were talking about a Russians, she said.
Reacher said nothing.
My father is an American, she said.
An American called Alexei Alexeyevich, Reacher said.
Our family came here before World War I. There's no possible connection. How could there be? These people were talking about our low-life Soviets.
What did your father do before he was a DA?
He was an assistant DA before that. He always worked there.
Tell me about his coffee service.
What about it?
He uses china cups and a silver tray. The county didn't buy them for him.
So?
Tell me about his suits.
His suits?
On Monday, he was wearing a $1,000 suit. You don't see many public servants wearing $1,000 suits.
He's got expensive tastes.
How does he afford them?
I don't want to talk about this.
One more question.
Helen said nothing. Did he pressure you not to take the case?
Helen said nothing, looked left, looked right. Then she turned around.
He said, losing might be winning.
Concern for your career?
I thought so. I still think so. He's an honest man.
Reacher nodded.
There's a 50% chance you're right.
Franklin came back in with the coffee, which was a thin, own-brand brew in three non-matching pottery mugs, two of them chipped, on a cork bar tray with an open carton of half-and-half and a yellow box of sugar and a single pressed steel spoon. He put the tray on the desk, and Helen Roden stared at it, like it was making Reacher's point for him. This is how coffee is served in an office.
David Chapman knew your name on Monday, she said. James Barr's first lawyer. He's known about you since Saturday.
But Chapman didn't know I ever showed up, Reacher said. I assume nobody told him. I knew your name, Franklin said. Maybe I should be in the mix, too. But you knew the real reason I was here, Reacher said. You wouldn't have had me attacked. You'd have had me subpoenaed.
Nobody spoke.
I was wrong about Jeb Oliver, Reacher said. He isn't a dope dealer. There was nothing in his barn except an old pickup truck.
I'm glad you can be wrong about something, Helen said.
Jeb Oliver isn't Russian, Franklin said. Apple pie, Reacher said. Therefore, these guys can work with Americans. That's what I'm saying. It could be Emerson. Doesn't have to be the DA. 50% chance, Reacher said. I'm not accusing anybody yet.
if you're right in the first place.
The bad guys were all over me very fast.
Doesn't sound like either Emerson or the DA to me, and I know them both.
You can say his name,
Helen said.
His name is Alex Roden.
I don't think it's either one of them, Franklin said.
I'm going back to work,
Helen said. Give me a ride? Reacher asked. Let me out onto the highway?
No,
Helen said.
I really don't feel like doing that.
She picked up her purse and her briefcase and walked out of the office alone.
Reacher sat still and listened to the sounds out on the street. He heard a car door opening and closing, an engine starting, a car driving away. He sipped his coffee and said,
I guess I upset her.
Franklin nodded.
I guess you did.
These guys have got someone on the inside. That's clear, right? That's a fact. So we should be able to discuss it.
A cop makes more sense than a DA.
I don't agree. A cop controls only his own cases. Ultimately, a prosecutor controls everything.
I prefer it that way.
I was a cop.
So was I, Reacher said.
And I have to say, Alex Roden kills a lot of cases. People say it's caution, but it could be something else.
You should analyze what kind of cases he kills.
Like I don't have enough to do already.
Reacher nodded, put his mug down, stood up. Start with Olene Archer, he said, the victim. She's what's important now.
Then he stepped to the window and checked the street. Saw nothing. So he nodded to Franklin and walked down the hallway and out the door to the top of the outside staircase. He paused on the top step and stretched in the warmth, rolled his shoulders, flexed his hands, took a deep breath of air. He was cramped from driving and sitting all day, and oppressed by hiding out. It felt good just to stand still and do nothing, high up and exposed, out in the open, in the daylight. Below him, to his left, the cars were gone, except for the black Suburban. The street was quiet. He glanced to his right. There was traffic building up on the north-south drag. To his left, there was less. He figured he would dodge west first, but a long way west, because the police station must be near. He would need to loop around it. Then he would head north. North of downtown was a warren. North of downtown was where he felt best. He started down the stairs. As he stepped off onto the sidewalk at the bottom, he heard a footfall 15 feet behind him. A sidestep, thin soles on limestone grit. Quiet. Then, the unmistakable crunch-crunch of a pump-action shotgun racking around. Then a voice, it said,
"Stop right there."
An American accent. Quiet, but distinct. From somewhere way north. Reacher stopped, stood still, and stared straight ahead at a blank brick wall across the street. The voice said,
"Step to your right."
Reacher stepped to his right, a long, sideways shuffle. The voice said,
"Now, turn around, real slow."
Reacher turned around, real slow. He kept his hands away from his body, palms out, saw a small figure 15 feet away, the same guy he had seen the night before from the shadows, not more than 5'4", not more than 130 pounds, slight, pale, with cropped black hair that stuck up crazily. Chenko, or Charlie. In his right hand, rock steady, was a sawn-off with a pistol grip. In his left hand was some kind of a black thing.
Catch,
Charlie said. He tossed the black thing underhand. Reacher watched it tumble and sparkle through the air straight at him, and his subconscious said, not a grenade. so he caught it. Two-handed. It was a shoe. A woman's patent leather dress shoe, black with a heel. It was still slightly warm.
"No, toss it back," Charlie said. "Just like I did."
Reacher paused. Whose shoe was it? He stared down at it. Low heel. Rosemary bars.
"Toss it back," Charlie called. "Nice and slow."
Assess and evaluate. Reacher was unarmed. He was holding a shoe. Not a stone, not a rock. The shoe was lightweight and unaerodynamic. It wouldn't do anyone any harm. It would stall and flutter in the air, and Charlie would just swat it away.
"Toss it back," Charlie said again.
Reacher did nothing. He could tear the heel off and throw it like a dart, like a missile, but Charlie would shoot him while he was drawing his arm back and winding up. Charlie was 15 feet away, poised, balanced, unblinking, with the gun rock steady in his hand. Too close to miss, too far to get to.
"Last chance," Charlie said.
Reacher soft tossed the shoe back. A long, looping underhand throw. Charlie caught it one-handed, and it was like the scene had rewound right back to the beginning.
"She's in summer school," Charlie said. "Think about it like that. She's going to get acquainted with the facts of life. She's going to work on her testimony about how her brother planned in advance, about how he let slip what he was going to do. She's going to be a great witness. She's going to make the case. You understand that, right?"
Reacher said nothing.
"So the game is over now," Charlie said.
Reacher said nothing.
"Take 2 steps backward," Charlie said.
Reacher took 2 steps backward. They put him right on the curb. Now Charlie was 20 feet away. He was still holding the shoe. He was smiling.
"Turn around," he said.
"You going to shoot me?" Reacher asked.
"Maybe."
"You should."
"Why?"
"Because if you don't, I'm going to find you and I'm going to make you sorry."
"Big talk."
"Not just talk."
"So, maybe I'll shoot you."
"You should."
"Turn around,"
Charlie said. Reacher turned around.
"Now, stand still,"
Charlie said. Reacher stood still, faced the street. He kept his eyes open, stared down at the blacktop. It was laid over ancient cobblestones. It was full of small humps in a regular pattern. He started counting them to fill what might be the last seconds of his life. He strained to hear sounds behind him, listened for the whisper of clothing as Charlie's arm extended, listened for the quiet, metallic click as the trigger moved through its first 1/10 of an inch. Would Charlie shoot? Common sense said no. Homicides were always investigated. But these people were crazy, and there was a 50% chance they owned a local cop, or that he owned them. Silence. Reacher strained to hear sounds behind him, but he heard nothing. Nothing happened. Nothing at all. 1 minute. 2. Then 100 yards away to the east, he heard a siren. Just 2 brief electronic blips from a cop car forcing a path through traffic.
"Stand still," Charlie said again.
Reacher stood still. 10 seconds. 20. 30. Then 2 police cruisers turned into the street simultaneously. one from the east and one from the west. They were both moving fast. Their engines roared, their tires howled. Their sounds beat against the brick. They jammed to a stop. Doors opened, cops spilled out. Reacher turned his head. Charlie wasn't there anymore. Chapter 14. The arrest was fast and efficient. It went down the usual way. Guns, shouting, handcuffs, Miranda. Reacher stayed silent throughout. He knew better than to speak. He had been a cop, and he knew the kind of trouble that talking can get a guy into, and the kind of delay it can cause. Say something, and the cops have to stop to write it down. And Reacher couldn't afford for anyone to stop, not right then. The trip to the station house was mercifully short, not more than 4 blocks. Reacher guessed it made sense that an ex-cop like Franklin would pick an office location in the neighborhood he was accustomed to. He used the drive time to work on a strategy. He figured he would be taken straight to Emerson, which gave him a 50% chance of being put in a room with a bad guy. Or with a good guy. But he ended up 100% sure that he was in a room with a bad guy, because Emerson and Alex Roden were both there together. Reacher was hauled out of the squad car and hustled straight to Emerson's office. Emerson was behind the desk. Roden was in front of it. Can't say a word, Reacher thought, but this has got to be real fast. Then he thought, which one, Roden or Emerson? Roden was wearing a suit, blue, summer weight, expensive, maybe the same one as on Monday. Emerson was in shirt sleeves, playing with a pen, bouncing it off his blotter one end, then the other. Get on with it, Reacher thought. You aren't so hard to find, Emerson said. Reacher said nothing. He was still handcuffed. Tell us about the night Alexandra Dupre was killed, Roden said. Reacher said nothing. Tell us how it felt, Emerson said, when her neck snapped. Reacher said nothing. The jury's going to hate you, Roden said. Reacher said, phone call. You want to lawyer up? Emerson said. Reacher said nothing. Who's your lawyer? Roden asked. Your daughter, Reacher said. Want us to call her? Emerson asked. Maybe. Or maybe Rosemary Barr instead. He watched their eyes. The sister? Roden said. You want us to call the sister? Emerson said. One of you knows she ain't going to answer, Reacher thought. Which one? Nothing in her eyes. Call Ann Yanni, he said. From the TV, Roden said. Why her? I get a phone call, Reacher said. I don't have to explain anything. I say who, you dial the number. She'll be getting ready to go on the air. The local news is at 6 o'clock. So we'll wait, Reacher said. I've got all the time in the world. Which one of you knows that isn't true? They waited, but it turned out the wait wasn't long. Emerson placed the call to NBC and told Ann Yanni's assistant that the police department had arrested Jack Reacher and that Reacher was requesting Yanni's presence, reason unknown. It was a bizarre message. But Yanni was in Emerson's office less than 30 minutes later. She was a journalist on the scent of a story. She knew that network tomorrow was better than local today. How can I help? She asked. She had presence. She was a star in her market. And she was media. Both Emerson and Roden looked a little intimidated, not by her as an individual, but by what she represented. I'm sorry, Reacher said to her. I know you won't want to, and I know I said I would never tell, but under the circumstances, You're going to have to confirm an alibi for me. No choice, I'm afraid. He glanced at her, saw her following his words, saw confusion cross her face. She had no reaction. He kept his eyes on hers. No reaction. Help me out here, girl. 1 second. 2 seconds. No reaction. Reacher held his breath. Get with the damn program, Yanni. 1 more second and it's all going to fall apart. No reaction. Then she nodded. She had caught on. Reacher breathed out. Good call. Professional skill. She was a person accustomed to hearing breaking news in her earpiece and repeating it live on air 1/2 second later, like she had known about it all her life.
What alibi? Emerson said.
Yanni glanced at him, then at Roden.
I thought this was about Jack Reacher, she said.
It is, Emerson said. But this is Joe Gordon, she said.
At least, that's what he told me.
He told you his name was Gordon?
When I met him.
Which was when?
2 days ago.
You've been running his picture on your show.
That was his picture? It looked nothing like him. The hair was totally different. No similarity at all.
What alibi? Emerson said again.
For when?
Yanni asked. The night the girl was killed. That's what we're talking about here. Yanni said nothing. Roden said, Ma'am, if you know something, you need to tell us now.
I'd rather not, Yanni said.
Reacher smiled to himself. The way she said it absolutely guaranteed that Emerson and Roden were a minute away from begging to hear the story. She was standing there, blushing on command all the way up to her temples, her back straight, her blouse open 3 buttons. She was a hell of an actress. Reacher figured maybe all news anchors were.
It's a question of evidence, Emerson said.
Obviously,
Yanni said.
But can't you just take my word?
For what?
That he didn't do it.
We need details, Roden said.
I have to think of my reputation, Yanni said.
Your statement won't be made public if we drop the charges.
Can you guarantee dropping the charges?
Not before we hear your statement, Emerson said.
So, it's a catch-22,
Yanni said.
I'm afraid it is.
Don't push too far, Reacher thought. We don't have time. Yanni sighed, looked down at the floor, looked up, straight into Emerson's eyes, furious, embarrassed, magnificent.
We spent that night together, she said.
You and Reacher.
Me and Joe Gordon.
Emerson pointed. This man. Yanni nodded.
That man.
All night.
Yes.
From when to when?
From about 11:40,
when the news was over, until I got paged the next morning when you guys found the body.
Where were you?
Reacher closed his eyes, recalled the conversation the night before in the parking garage, the car window, open 1.5 inches.
Had he told her? The motor court,
Yanni said.
His room.
The clerk didn't say he saw you.
Of course the clerk didn't see me. I have to think about things like that.
Which room? Had he told her?
Room 8,
Yanni said. He didn't leave the room during the night.
No, he didn't.
Not at all?
No.
How can you be sure? Yanni looked away.
Because we didn't actually sleep a wink.
The office went quiet. Can you offer any corroboration? Emerson asked.
Like what?
Yanni asked back. Distinguishing marks? That I can't see right now, but that someone who had been in your position would have seen? Oh, please. It's the last question, Emerson said. Yanni said nothing. Richard recalled switching on the Mustang's dome light and lifting his shirt to reveal the tire iron. He moved his cuffed hands and laid them across his waistband. Anything? Emerson said. It's important, Roden said.
He has a scar,
Yanni said, low down on his stomach. A horrible big thing. Emerson and Roden both turned and looked at Reacher. Reacher got to his feet, grabbed a fold of fabric in both hands and pulled his shirt out of his pants, lifted it. Okay, Emerson said. What was that? Roden asked. Part of a Marine sergeant's jawbone, Reacher said. The medics figured it must have weighed about 4 ounces. It was traveling at 5,000 feet per second away from the epicenter of a trinitrotoluene explosion, just surfing along on the pressure wave, until it hit me. He dropped his shirt back down, didn't try to tuck it in. The handcuffs would have made that difficult. Satisfied now? He asked. Have you embarrassed the lady enough? Emerson and Roden looked at each other. One of you knows for sure I'm innocent, Reacher thought, and I don't care what the other one thinks. Miss Yanni will have to put it in writing, Emerson said.
You type it, I'll sign it, Yanni said.
Roden looked straight at Reacher. Can you offer corroboration? Like what? Something along the lines of your scar, but relating to Ms. Yanni? Reacher nodded. Yes, I could, but I won't. And if you ask again, I'll knock your teeth down your throat. Silence in the office. Emerson dug in his pocket and found a handcuff key, turned suddenly, and tossed it underarm through the air. Reacher's hands were cuffed, but he was careful to lead with his right. He caught the key in his right palm and smiled. Bell Antonio been talking to you? He said. Why did you give Miss Yanni a false name? Emerson asked. Maybe I didn't, Reacher said. Maybe Gordon is my real name. He tossed the key back and stepped over and held his wrists out and waited for Emerson to unlock the cuffs. The Zec took the phone call 2 minutes later. A familiar voice, low and hurried.
It didn't work, it said. He had an alibi.
For real?
Probably not, but we're not going to go there.
So what next?
Just sit tight. He can't be more than one step away now, in which case he'll be coming for you soon. So be locked and loaded and ready for him.
They didn't fight very hard,
Ann Yanni said, did they? She started the Mustang's engine before Reacher even got his door closed. I didn't expect them to, he said. The innocent one knows the case was weak, and the guilty one knows putting me back on the street takes me off the board about as fast as putting me in a cell right now.
Why?
Because they've got Rosemary Barr and they know I'll go find her. So they'll be waiting for me, ready to rock and roll. I'll be dead before morning. That's the new plan. Cheaper than jail. They drove straight back to Franklin's office and ran up the outside staircase and found Franklin sitting at his desk. The lights were off, and his face was bathed in the glow from his computer screen. He was staring at it blankly, like it was telling him nothing. Reacher broke the news about Rosemary Barr. Franklin went very still and glanced at the door, then the window. We were right here, he said. Reacher nodded. Three of us, you,
me and Helen. I didn't hear anything.
Me either, Reacher said.